I was on Twitter and everyone was like, Capital's like, what is happening?
Keep up to date with the latest WSL action and the biggest interviews.
It's just a measure of how their season has been going. They can't catch a break no matter how hard they're trying.
Subscribe to the Koi Gig podcast stream on the OTV Sports app now.
Colm, we also had a survey which is in the back pages of the newspapers today. It was a Tenio Sports survey which came out. It was 1,000 people who were surveyed in all. And according to the people, as you can probably see on screen now, the most admired Irish athlete, Katie Taylor, 16%, Kelly Harrington, 14%. So those two boxers accounting for more than a quarter of all the votes here. Rachel Blackmore, who had her winning weekend with the Irish Times Awards, the BBC World Sportsperson, and also the RT Sportsperson of the Year across the weekend on 9%, along with Johnny Sexton, the Ireland and Leinster rugby captain. Paula Donovan, 4%. I'm sure we'll get your Cork opinion on that in a moment. I thought he was very unlucky, along with Fintan, not to win Team of the Year at the RT Awards of the weekend. Ellen Keane on 4%. Tadhg Furlong on 4%, and the Ireland soccer captain Katie McCabe also on 4%. They're the most admired athlete. We'll talk about the moment of the year and the sports teams in a moment, Colm, but just to go with most admired, probably no great surprise that Katie Taylor and Kelly Harrington are there. Like, Katie Taylor probably steps up for her next year with Amanda Serrano, which is the fight we've been waiting for so long, but she's come through 2021 with her undisputed lightweight world titles in tow. And Kelly Harrington, for me, probably moment of the year, was getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning to watch her final at the Tokyo Games. She's been embraced, but I notice across this survey, there's not actually a huge, let's say, love reflection on the Olympic teams. Is that because everything was at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning and maybe people didn't attach on in the way they usually do for an Olympics? Or what do you think the reasoning is behind that?
Yeah, I think there are a variety of reasons that people really get attached to someone. I think it's easier when it's an individualistic sport, something like that, if people aren't necessarily avid fans of the particular sport. And I think if a team is really going to catch the imagination, I think each member has to have a really big personality or distinctive character trait, or something really monumental has to happen in their chosen sport to really capture the public imagination. So I think that leaves us with the more individual sports. And it's absolutely no surprise to see Kelly Harrington up so high. And it's actually great to see, because, like you referred to it there with that Olympic final, I actually can't remember any sporting event where I was more nervous, especially in the second round. I remember watching it, and it wasn't just the stereotypical edge of your seat, but I was shaking a little. You know, it was kind of an uncontrollable moment, because I really, really wanted her to win. And then when she did, and just the pure unadulterated joy on her face, and then the homecoming. And like, it's been such a dark year, dark 2 years. And for Kelly Harrington just to light up the country and again transcend the sport, everybody for those few days were just on high as a result of her achievements. And I think that's what really captures the public imagination. And that's sport at its best. You know, sport at its best garners interest from people who have absolutely no interest in it. And that's what it can do, because it's all down to human emotion. So I think that's why you're seeing so many individualistic sports up there, because the best sports stars are a reflection of the people themselves. And I think Kelly Harrington is a national treasure as a result.
Yeah, I wonder if her humility and, you know, Hakuna Matata, and just how relaxed she was during the Olympics. And I guess that access that you get from an interview that takes place after each fight, and where she was very much to the fore. Like, this kind of reminds me of when it was the O'Donovan brothers who were in the boat together back in 2016. That, like, their popularity exploded because of how interesting they were after the races. And so many people started watching rowing because it was like, these two guys are remarkably entertaining. Not only are they incredibly good athletes, but they also make for good television.
Yeah, I mean, look, how interesting is rowing to people who have no interest in it? You know, it's really hard to get into rowing, because you're just watching this repetitive exercise. Now, the rowing community will be like, what are you talking about? You don't know, you're so ignorant. What are you talking about?
You're going to be banned from Cork, Colm. You're not going to get back home for Christmas.
I bring it home, Will, don't worry. I bring it around. But I would say, like, if you're looking at this, like, objective repetition of motion, you're like, oh, my God, you know, what's going to happen? Is there a through ball that can happen here? Like, is there a red card or something? Can I stick my teeth into this? But then you have the characters and they get out of the boat and they talk, and then, okay, I'm immediately buying into this, because these guys are so passionate about what they do. And if you listen to someone who has passion about what they do, you're immediately a bit interested, no matter what it is, because you're buying into them as people. And that's what happened with Paul and Gary O'Donovan at 2016 Olympics. And as a result, we've seen in subsequent years is that, you know, Paul is genuinely world-class in his field and, you know, described as a bit of a genetic freak. Mm. And Fintan McCarthy's brilliant too, but Fintan would say the same thing about Paul. And then, you know, you have kind of the, you know, maybe the bittersweet element too that Gary, I think, as Paul and Fintan took home the gold in Tokyo, was, I think, reportedly, you know, in the air, might not have even seen the race. And, you know, you do feel for him a bit too, and you think there might be a bit of a divide in the family about being absolutely thrilled for one member and then, you know, a bit sad for the other. So, you know, that narrative, I guess, again, just continues to capture the imagination. But it's the people in the boat that really that we're getting behind. And to have genuine world-class athletes like Paul and Fintan, like Kelly Harrington, like Katie Taylor, like, it is absolutely brilliant because, like, I get a bit tired of the stereotype of Irish sports people that, you know, we try very hard, we give it our all, but we kind of lack a bit of skill. But that's absolutely not the case. But we actually are quite skillful across a number of sports. And I think in 2021, we've displayed that on a world stage. And there's an awful lot to be proud of as a result.
Yeah, I think it's not insignificant as well when you look at this on the back of the promotion of women's sport over the last 18 months in particular with 2020. You've got Katie Taylor, Kelly Harrington, Rachel Blackmore, Ellen Keane and Katie McCabe all inside the top seven here. Like, it's a pretty female-dominated most admired list. Moment of the year, no great surprise, we talked about it already, Kelly Harrington's gold coming in at 20%. The Ireland rugby team beating New Zealand at 19%, I wonder, is a combination of maybe those who were surveyed and also a certain amount of recency bias too. Look, it was great to have a full crowd back at the Aviva Stadium, but ultimately it was an Autumn International as opposed to, I think, the 11% Rachel Blackmore's wins at Aintree and Cheltenham are far more significant. Winning the champion hurdle, becoming top jockey at Cheltenham, winning the Aintree Grand National, first female jockey ever to do so. 10% coming in for the rowing gold at the Olympics. So, like, there's a big split in terms of moment of the year. But I'm not sure, Colm, if the Ireland team beating New Zealand, as fine a performance as it was, is it really the second best Irish sporting moment of the year?
Yeah, totally. And do you know why? It was...
Above Olympic gold medals.
Well, it was a controlled, relatively comfortable victory in the end, and the reason that it's so high up is because, again, it was kind of displaying world-class tendencies, I would say, when it comes to the rugby team. Not quite a world-class team yet, but it was a really well-deserved victory, whereas the one in 2018 was so unbelievably dramatic, and then in Chicago before that, it was like, oh my god, this feels like an incredible one-off achievement that we can all celebrate as a nation and remember it fondly years on. But the most recent iteration of the victory against New Zealand was very kind of calm, controlled, measured victory. And I think there's a lot to be said for that because, as I was saying there, with the when you're caught up with the emotion of a sport that you might not be that interested in, this is a national sport that, you know, we're one of the best countries in the world at. And we actually illustrated it that day with kind of a consummate professional victory over, you know, the great All Blacks. And I actually fully agree that it should be that high. I think with Rachel Blackmore, this is just a complete theory, obviously, and, you know, clearly an opinion. But it's because that, I think it's because her dominance was so consistent throughout that week that maybe there wasn't one solidified moments that you could grab onto. I'm just speculating. That's maybe
what about the Grand National? The Grand National genuinely sticks out as that.
Completely. No, I completely. But because it wasn't just that, maybe that's why it's a bit lower. Because there wasn't one particular moment like you're looking at reading in the years in 20 years' time. Is that the absolute moment that we can grab onto that? Okay. That was the best sporting moment of the year.
See,
maybe.
I think now, if you want a reading in the years moment column on rugby, right, and Ireland beat New Zealand, if Ireland beat New Zealand in France in 2023, then that becomes a reading in the years moment. I think this is a victory in a test match that's part of an autumn series where the All Blacks were wrecked. We saw that against France as well. Enjoy the moment, by all means, but I don't know how that gets ahead of Blackmore. I don't know how that gets ahead of the guys winning the gold medal in the rowing. Again, to each their own. This is a survey of only 1,000 people as well. Favourite team then We had the Olympics Irish team getting 24%. The men's rugby team coming in on 22%, which is again why I wonder about maybe some of the people who were surveyed here by putting the men's rugby team up there. Albeit they had a good year. They won, what, 8 test matches during the year. Paralympics at 15%. You've got the women's soccer team coming in at 12%. I think they've gained a lot of love with the extended exposure that they've gotten with all the TV coverage and also marketing campaigns, and they've been very much out to the fore. I'm a little bit surprised, Colm, to be honest, the Limerick hurling team gets 12%, because I think at some point people will turn against the Limerick team if they continue to dominate hurling. And already there's a bit of a discussion about whether they overstep the mark physically and the way that they play the game. It always happens when a team is successful. I think when Limerick first came through in 2018, it was like a famine has been ended since the 1970s. They play some great hurling. Look at the players they have, the way they move the ball. They can shoot from all over the pitch. Now that they've been, you know, collecting multiple league titles, Munster titles, and, you know, they've dominated the All-Ireland over the last 3 seasons, I think at some point that love for the Limerick hurling team is going to turn, a little bit like the Dublin football team. Like, no one really begrudged the Dublin football team at the turn of the last decade. But once it started to turn into 4 All-Irelands in a row, 5 All-Irelands in a row, people wanted the change and someone else to win.
Yeah, 2011 seems a long time ago for Dublin's victory, you know, from 1995 to then. And now it's like, oh God, Dublin. And yeah, Limerick, like, I was there that day, 2018, the semi-final when Cork were 8 points ahead with 8 minutes to go, I think.
Yep.
And then Limerick were, you know, they, I think Dowling came on and just changed the whole game. And now 3 years on, you're like, yeah, Limerick are absolutely unbelievable. But I absolutely don't begrudge their consistent success, because they make hurling so enjoyable to watch. Like, is it tiki-taka, Limerick's hurling? Because their passing is just unbelievable to watch. Like, they're a genuine joy. And if that success and I wouldn't say dominance, but certainly being the best team in the country, if that continues for the next decade, I don't think I'll have much of a problem. If you sprinkle in a Cork victory here and there, will you know, I'll absolutely take that. But no, they're a joy. They're absolutely a joy. But I think your point is interesting, that will people start getting sick of them? You see, people get sick of winners. You know, I don't know if it's a national psyche that we don't like people who are too obvious and insist upon themselves that they're so good over a prolonged period of time. Like, as a country, do we just like a one-off winner that's very humble about it? And, you know, I'm very thankful for all the support, and it was just great to be out there, and I can't believe I won. I couldn't have done it without you. Mm. And then they kind of disappear for a while, especially as a team. But I think it's great. I think we should embrace this American style of absolute dominance, whether it's on the domestic or international front.
Well, see, I think the only thing Limerick need now, which is outside of their own control, they need a dance partner. So they need a team who get up to their level consistently, and there's a series of interesting games between them. Because one of the reasons that Dublin became such an interesting team to watch was because of the battles they had against Mayo. Mayo came up short and Dublin came out on top pretty much in all of them. But Dublin's brilliance was actually improved by Mayo being a really good opponent for them during the period where they were successful. We saw Kilkenny match up very well against Limerick in 2019 and beat them in a semi-final. But generally, Limerick have found the answer against the rest of the teams around them in the All-Ireland Championship. They could do with Henry Shefflin making Galway excellent, or Kilkenny getting back up to a level, or Tipperary next year getting back to their 2019 level again and being a very, very difficult opponent to shake off. I think that makes Limerick a little bit more interesting. I want to talk to you about Drive to Survive in a moment, just to tell you about the other one, which is the event that people are most looking forward to in 2022. Six Nations on 29%, the FIFA World Cup 26%, All-Ireland Hurling at 12%, and All-Ireland Football at 9%. The one that surprised me is the World Cup at 26%, because I think a lot of people are, you know, football fans are sharing concerns about the time it's on, where it is, what it's going to have an impact on the domestic season. But yet, sports fans appear to be still very interested in the World Cup. Favourite sport, tennis coming in at 6%. Let's find a way to actually to get that up the way here, Colm. You've been looking at the idea of potentially, we call it a Drive for Survive style programme, potentially, for the tennis circuit. And I think what I mean is not directly like the makers of Drive to Survive doing it, because I think some of the people who are involved in that production with Netflix are now looking at horse racing currently, and potentially some other sports could come under the banner because it's been so successful and has drawn in an audience. And I think it's actually improved Formula One's appeal hugely among casual sports fans. If a tennis series was to come out, who are we following? Who's going to be interesting if there was a TV series about tennis right now?
First of all, it should be called What a Racket, if it is to be a series. Or New Balls, please. Or just New Balls, exclamation point, like Airplane, exclamation point. So I've been working on names. there's so much to follow, Will. There's so much. You see, you have the big three in the men's game, and they're all coming to the end now, and they're all tied on 20 Grand Slams each. So that's, of course, Novak Djokovic, Rafael Nadal, and Roger Federer. So you have that narrative. You want to see that behind the scenes. Then you have Serena Williams, who is chasing that elusive 24th Grand Slam, the American court record. She's been on 23 for a number of years now. She's reached four Grand Slam finals since she's come back from her maternity leave, and she's lost them all quite convincingly. And both she and Federer are now 40, and you think their chances of adding to their already, you know, monumental haul is more limited with each passing week, month, and year. And the reason that a Drive to Survive style documentary would be so interesting would be to, I suppose, see them in their, you know, not to be too voyeuristic, but see them in their lower moments, just to see the real side of them. And you see, the thing with, like, the thing with this whole series, right, Formula One, is that, you know, it was a bit of a polarizing sport. Like, the fans of Formula One were, you know, you won't get much more passionate, but there was a lot of people outside, you know, to use your dancing analogy there, that Limerick need a dance partner. You know, Formula One fans were like the young fella at a wedding with the tie around the head, sliding on the knees. And the rest of us were on the outside, like the aunt and uncle who might go up for a little dance and walk away.
So you're trying to say they preferred him as a bit more pure, when, like, maybe Formula One wasn't quite as mass appeal, and everyone was sitting down last Sunday week to watch that crazy final lap to see if Verstappen could get past Lewis Hamilton. Like, probably what helped Drive to Survive, and this would be important for tennis too, and look, I think tennis is interesting enough to make this a good series, is that Drive to Survive may well have drawn eyeballs to the sport, but the magnificent title race that was there this season also increased the interest in Formula One. I think if you get a Drive for Survive style tennis, and you get, say, Serena Williams losing a Grand Slam final and potentially having the cameras embedded with her camp while she's throwing a tantrum after losing, or Novak Djokovic doesn't win Australia next month and the cameras are along with them, that makes particularly interesting viewing. We actually, it's one of those things where you can open the door and get an idea of what the sports people are like behind the interview that we hear on centre court after they lose or win a match.
Mm. Well, like, there's absolutely no question that the Verstappen-Hamilton rivalry was brought to a far wider audience because of Drive to Survive. I mean, there's just no doubt about that. So for the last two Sundays, people have been glued to their screens because of Drive to Survive, a lot of people. And they are buying into the personalities, which is kind of the theme of the morning that we've discussed so far, is the personality behind sports people. And I, as a tennis fan and someone who talks about tennis on off the ball a lot, you know, sometimes you kind of get a polarizing reaction in that you get a lot of passionate people about certain players, and then a lot of apathy towards others, because those others, they're not really that well known and their personalities don't come to the fore. And tennis can be often a very cold and individualistic sport.
Is there a little bit as well, Colm, of a kind of a Cristiano Ronaldo, Leo Messi type thing here, where you get some fans who are so wedded to Roger Federer that therefore they will play down the achievements of Rafa Nadal or a Djokovic. You're almost like you're a Djokovic, Nadal or Federer fan, as opposed to being a wider tennis fan who can maybe appreciate that all three are among the best players of all time.
Oh, it's like a football team. Like, will you look at the comment section, right, on a recent Novak Djokovic segment that we would have done on OTBAM, and to describe some of the comments as vitriolic would be generous. I mean, people are like waving their Djokovic scarves around, taking off their shirt, have Novak's face tattooed on their body, like that episode of Alan Partridge with the Stalker. Like, serious love eyes towards certain players, and as you say, complete disregard towards others, or more to the point, disregard towards pundits' opinions of them if they're not too generous. So, you know, Gerard Gilroy and I would not be a fan of Novak Djokovic, and every time we discuss him, the comment section goes pretty wild. So it's a really interesting thing, because when we do tennis on the show, sometimes, you know, the videos have crazy huge views and loads of engagement in the comments. And then other times people just aren't that interested in it, because for the lesser known players, there's nothing to get in about the sport, right? And tennis does itself no favors. It really needs to modernize. And there actually is talk of doing a Drive to Survive for tennis, just like there's horse racing. And Mariam Bartoli, who won Wimbledon in 2013, she says that tennis needs a behind-the-scenes documentary to actually showcase the real personalities, because there are some brilliant people in tennis. There's some really great personalities, and there's so much beef as well, Will, because it's such a selfish sport, and everybody's out for themselves. So, like, I'll give you one example off the top of my head. US Open last year, or this year, sorry, Stefanos Tsitsipas against Andy Murray in the first round. Now, those two guys do get on, But Tsitsipas is going for a number of bathroom breaks and medical timeouts. And Murray was absolutely fuming at him, right? And let the umpire know on no uncertain terms. Now, the mics pick up certain things that they say. And all you want is to hear what they're saying when they're away from the court and behind the scenes, because you know it's way worse than that. And like after that incident, when Tsitsipas kept him going to the bathroom, taking ages to come back, completely destroying Murray's momentum. That was a 5-set victory for Tsitsipas, so it went all the way. So Tsitsipas knew what he was doing. Andy Murray tweeted afterwards, fact of the day, it takes Stefanos Tsitsipas twice as long to go to the bathroom as it takes Jeff Bezos to fly into space. Interesting. So, right, you get that real passive aggression that you've always had with Andy Murray anyway. He's very good at it. And then you magnify that to both the WTA and ATP tours, fill them in the locker rooms where they're going around talking to each other, saying what to each other under each other's breath. It would be absolutely beautiful. And like, will you take just the last year alone, right? If there was a drive to survive, or what a racket, as we'll call it, for the last year, you have like the Australian Open. Do you remember that with the quarantining issues?
Yep.
Where 72 players had to go into hard hotel quarantine for 2 weeks. And actually, Jennifer Brady was one of those players, and she reached the final despite not leaving her hotel room for a fortnight. So can you imagine getting the opinions of Novak Djokovic behind the scenes? Because he was the one who said to the Australian officials, look, any chance that these quarantine restrictions can be eased for us? Can we get, you know, nicer food? Can we see our coaches? And then you have Nick Kyrgios responding to that, saying, what a tool, about Djokovic. So you just love to see that beef. And you and I were texting last night about this ahead of the segment and said, for Nick Kyrgios alone, you invest in this series.
That's the episode everyone would watch. Like, you'd be intrigued by, say, Raducanu's US Open victory.
Oh, yeah.
Would be like a great episode in and of itself. But just watching Nick Kyrgios talk crap about his fellow players would be the one that you'd sit down to watch. You'd probably put it right middle of the series.